Welcome to the 127th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Django Wexler, the author of the new Flintlock fantasy novel, The Thousand Names. Stay tuned for the interview. So welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Django Wexler, author of a new fantasy novel, The Thousand Names, Book One of the Shadow Campaigns. Django, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, glad to be here.
Sure. Well, at the outset, can I have you read the first couple of pages or a couple of pages from your new novel, The Thousand Names?
Sure. This is a section from Chapter 6. Our protagonist, Winter, who is, I'm not sure it's relevant for this particular chapter, but she's in disguise as a man to be a part of the Vordanai army, is leading her troops on a scouting mission and is just about to encounter the enemy. All right. Bobby drifted over to Winter. The boy was plainly exhausted, sweat running down his face in rivulets, but he struggled gamely onward under the weight of pack and musket. He even managed a smile. He labored for a moment to catch his breath. Aren't we getting a bit far out? Winter snorted. DeVries thinks the colonel has ordered him to personally chase down the entire enemy army. He'll get a dressing down from Captain Devoir, I bet. Maybe, Winter shrugged. Captain Devoir is a busy man. Think he'll call a halt when we get to the top of the next ridge? God almighty, I hope so. Winter looked at the perspiring troops now struggling up the slope. Otherwise, we won't even need to run into the Redeemers. The sun's bad enough. Bobby nodded wearily. They walked on in silence, picking their way around occasional screes of loose rock or clumps of hardy shrubs and grass. This ridge was taller than the one that ran along the road, and Winter imagined it would afford quite a view. She hoped that DeVries would be satisfied with taking a look from the top. There was a surprised shriek from her right, followed by a burst of laughter. Sarge, I think something bit Cooper. More laughter. Winter left Bobby's side and hurried over to a small group of soldiers, acutely aware that getting bit by something in Kandar was no laughing matter. In the city, she'd known a Kandari trapper who'd claimed there were 107 varieties of snakes in the Lesser Dassault and at least a dozen kinds of scorpions. Each was dangerous in its own particular way. On inspection, however, Cooper turned out merely to have stepped in a pricker bush, whose barbed thorns had snagged his trousers and drawn angry red scratches down his leg. Winter got the lad disentangled, much to the amusement of his companions. As she straightened up, there were shouts from above at the top of the ridge. Winter thought at first that another man had had an encounter with local wildlife, but from the volume it sounded as though the whole company had stumbled into a nest of snakes. Above it she heard the high, shrill voice of the lieutenant. "Back! Go back!" He came into sight over the top of the ridge, his terrified horse moving far too fast already, blood spotting the animal's flanks where he'd kicked it viciously with his spurs. A few soldiers followed, picking their way down the rocky slope as fast as their legs would carry them. Winter spat a curse. She forced herself to move, sprinting the last dozen yards to the crest of the ridge, and found most of the 7th Company still gathered there. The thin line had contracted to a tight bunch as the soldiers instinctively huddled together. The top of the ridge afforded an excellent view. Over her shoulder, Winter could see the ocean, though the coast road and the Vordanai army were blocked by the lower ridge behind them. Ahead of her, to the south, the furrowed land stretched on and on until it flattened out into the sandy wastes of the Lesser Dassault. The objects of the soldiers' attention were closer at hand, however. Off to the east, the coast road became visible again as it swung inland to avoid some obstacle, and there a vast host had gathered. It looked more like a camp than an army, with tents and crude banners showing the crimson flame of the Redeemers on a black field. Men milled around, reduced to ants by the distance, and there was no mistaking the flash of the sun from polished steel blades. Spreading south and east from the camp was an apparently endless tide of horsemen. They rode in small groups of 20 or 30, and there were more groups than Winter could count, covering the valley at the foot of the ridge. They were shabby-looking men, ununiformed and mounted on scrawny beasts liberated from lives as carts or field animals. But they screamed and drew swords when they saw Vordanai blue against the horizon. priests in black wraps egged them on, screaming loudest of all and waving the riders forward. The lieutenant was still shouting, barely audible over the shrieks of the redeemers. Back! Back to the column! I think I'd probably cut it there.
Okay. Great. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about The Thousand Names yet, how would you describe your new novel?
Let's see. My elevator pitch, as they say, has become that it's Bernard Cornwall sharp, but with magic. It was originally based on the Napoleonic Wars. My first idea was to actually just do a fantasy retelling of the story of Napoleon Bonaparte, but it kind of diverged enormously from that. And so what it left me with is this military fantasy in set in a time frame that's like maybe 1790 in our world, although it's a secondary world, but that's what the technology roughly is about. So, you know, muskets and cannons and cavalry charges, but also magic in a kind of a subtle, interesting way.
Great. Well, as you mentioned, many fantasy novels tend to focus on a quasi-medieval setting with knights and armor and sword fights, but your novel, it has guns, muskets, cannons, and also magic. What inspired you to write what is being referred to as a flintlock fantasy versus a fantasy with a medieval setting?
I just love that that term flintlock fantasy didn't exist while I was writing it, and it's only happened once I come out. A few people seem to have gotten the same idea all at once. There's me, Brian McClellan, Leigh Bardugo, and a couple of others have written these fantasies that take place in this time. I'm really happy about that. For me, it was, saying that I'm a fan of George R.R. Martin is kind of cliche now, but in 2000, which is about when I was reading him for the first time before the HBO series, you know, this it's hard to remember how much of a revelation that was, that he took this sort of knights and castles medieval fantasy and brought it back closer to its historical roots, that you know, it was not such a nice time, particularly for the people who were not lords and ladies. And that, you know, that really resonated with me, and I love the idea of doing a fantasy, but taking a lot of inspiration from history. And I also felt like George Martin had kind of done the Knights and Castles thing maybe as well as anyone was going to do it. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to do the sort of historically based fantasy, I need to do something else. And it had always been a little weird to me that with all of history over the whole world to choose from, fantasy authors for their archetype basically focus on the 13th century in England, or even a sort of weird version of the 13th century filtered through Malory and Tolkien and D&D. So I thought, okay, you know, let's do something else. And then I read a book, called The Campaigns of Napoleon by David Chandler, which is a spectacular history, which I recommend to everyone if you're into you know, campaigns. and I thought, this is it. This is what I want to do. And so that's kind of what I ended up doing.
That's great. Well, when you started working on The Thousand Names, as you just described, did you have the magical element in mind from the beginning? Because as you've mentioned, and you know, as the book shows, I mean, you know, a vast portion of the book could be read as you know, kind of a take on Napoleonic, you know, without a ton of magic. So I just wondered, you know, what the process was for you in kind of integrating that magical element into the overall plot.
It's interesting. So I knew that there was going to be a magic system because I needed. You know, I'm a fantasy fan at heart. It would be hard for me to write a book without one. I love that stuff. But at the same time, because I wanted to write this sort of military fantasy, I wanted the battles and the non-magical characters to matter. And I find in a lot of books, you know, it, when there's magicians who can destroy armies by waving their hands, then the non-magicians always feel sort of pointless. Stephen Erikson does a good job of this in his books, that his magicians are so powerful that they're the only people worth talking about, essentially. This is in the Malazan Book of the Fallen.
Right.
So, and I like that too, but that's just not the way I want it to go, since it would feel kind of silly to do, to have really powerful magic and to then spend a bunch of time on soldiers fighting. So I designed the magic system so that it was kind of subtle and hidden. It's at this point where, I mean, there's this organization basically designed to getting dedicated to getting rid of magic, and they've gotten to the point where most civilized people don't even believe that it still exists or that it ever existed. And that was a kind of an interesting take on it. So it was always there, you know, in my mind, but I didn't want it to dominate the plot. At least not initially. So that's kind of why it is the way it is. At the same time, the book has a prologue from the point of view of one of the bad guys, or maybe bad guys, it depends on how you look at things, that shows off some of the magic, which I put in there at least partly to just show, yes, this is a fantasy book, and yes, it does have magic in it, you know, if you wait. I didn't want to put anyone off to think that they had, you know, people had might think, oh, I thought this was fantasy, but I guess not.
How much have you planned your series beyond the first novel? Do you have a projected number of novels at this point in the series, or are you focused strictly on the immediate sequel?
It's pretty well planned. It's going to be 5 books, assuming everything goes well. I mean, you know, I never want to speak too certainly about it. You know, we all remember, you know, George Martin telling us that his series would be 6 books long, and then it's 7, and now, you know, God only knows. But but when I first submitted the novel to my agent, he said, okay, before I go out with this to the publishers, I'm going to need a synopsis of the rest of the series, of all the other books. And I said, oh. And that was kind of the first time I'd really thought hard about it. But it turned out to be incredibly valuable, because I did this synopsis, which, you know, ended up being quite extensive and detailed. And a lot of that stuff made it back into the Thousand Names. So I think it makes the series, like, tighter as a whole. It was actually kind of a conversion experience for me in terms of planning a lot. I had never really been a big planner, but I got a real good look at how valuable it is, even if it's kind of painful to do. So it's actually pretty well planned. The second book is written. I'm editing it now. I can't speak for the publishers, but I think we're hoping for a July release next year, and we're going to try and do one per year. So, you know, hopefully in 5 years we'll get them all out. That's the goal anyway.
That's great. Well, what has your personal writing path been? Had you written any novels or short stories prior to The Thousand Names? And specifically with The Thousand Names, what was the path to publication like for that novel? You just mentioned you have an agent. So if you could just talk about that.
Sure. So I've been a writer for a long time, since high school, at least. I wrote short stories for a while. I got into fan fiction. I wrote fan fiction for a while. In college, I finally decided, okay, I'm going to write a fantasy novel that I can sell. So not a fan fiction novel. And I did. It was called Memories of Empire, and I sold it to a small press called Medallion Press. And I sold them another one called Shinigami, which, you know, it was a good learning experience. It's odd. It's not like I'm ashamed of those books, but they're not my best work to date either. But they came out, and basically not that many people read them, and they disappeared without a trace. And so now they're out of print. Someday, I'm going to convince someone to bring them back, at least as an ebook or something like that, just as a historical curiosity. But then I wrote another book and I was like, man, this isn't very good. So finally I decided, okay, I'm going to, you know, after doing the small press, I said, I'm going to get an agent and get a, you know, I thought of it as a real publisher, which is really not fair because there are a lot of small presses that do really tremendous work. But that's what I thought at the time. So I did, you know, I wrote Thousand Names, and it took a lot longer than I expected because, among other things, I ended up moving across the country and changing jobs completely in that time frame. So it took about 5 years to actually get it written, and went through many, many versions. But once I did, then I just started sending it to agents. You know, it's funny because I feel like there should be like some clever story about a guy that I met at a convention or something. But I use a website called agentquery.com, and I got a list of the agents who I thought might bite. And there were about 50 of them, and I sent them all queries. And I think I got probably 2 positive responses. And my agent, Seth Fishman, it actually took him 2 tries to successfully, you know, read the book. He turned me down the first time, but I kind of got another shot at him, and he loved it the second time.
I'm just curious, what was that second shot? Did you revise it and send it back to him?
It turns out I had a personal connection. His a guy at his agency knows somebody that I know, and they were like, hey, do you know this Django Wexler guy? And he's like, I think I rejected him. And they're like, did you read his book? I don't know. You'd have to ask Seth exactly how that went down.
But
what he said to me later was that at the time I first queried him, his roster was like really full. And then the second time he had just gotten an assistant and kind of expanded responsibilities and was looking for new stuff. So the moral is hopefully not that like you need personal connections, because I really don't think that makes much of a difference, but rather that, you know, keep trying, because getting turned down by someone is almost never like personal. It's usually has much more to do with just where they are at any given time.
Sure.
Anyway, so Seth took the book, and we did another draft based on his feedback. The big obstacle was that it's really long for an unknown author to do. I mean, Thousand Names at the time was about 215,000 words, where 100,000 words is usually considered about right for a fantasy novel. And so he thought that was going to be tricky, but we managed to sell it. We ended up cutting it down by about 30,000 words. We cut about 10% out of it by the time it actually went out. But that was with the assistance of my editor at Penguin. And I think it helped a lot. So that's kind of where
where does it clock in now in terms of word count?
It's at about 195,000.
Wow. Cause it doesn't read that long at all. I mean, in terms of the pacing.
Yeah. Well, fantasy is kind of a weird genre, because the big names in fantasy write these enormous books. You know, sure. I think, Pat Rothfuss's The Wise Man's Fear is like 400,000 words or some gigantic number. The publishers don't like that, because, you know, it's riskier for them to print these gigantic books. And so if you're a new author, it's easy to think, oh, well, everybody writes these huge tomes. And I obviously thought that too. It makes it a little harder to sell. So I got lucky in that respect.
Sure. So what advice do you have for aspiring writers who may be listening, who would one day like to have a career selling their novels and short stories?
So number one is just keep writing all the time. It's funny because people keep talking about this as my debut novel, which I guess is true. For me, this is novel number 9 or 10, depending on how you count them. And so it's not like this is the first book I wrote and I sent it out and, you know, oh, here it is. You know, there's a bunch sitting in a trunk somewhere that I will probably never see the light of day because they're not very good. So don't just, you know, write one book and think this is it, this is my shot. And then if it doesn't work, you're like, oh man, I'm sad. Just keep going. And it can take a while. you got to get used to rejection and realize that people don't mean it seriously, or not seriously, but personally. You know, I always try to picture the scene at a publisher or an agent's office where you have some unpaid intern who's reading, you know, 50 manuscripts a day, and his job is to pass maybe one onto his boss for consideration. And so, you know, when that guy rejects you, it's not because, you know, he's like, you are the worst person ever. And I see a lot of aspiring writers getting really upset by rejection, and it's just not, it's not that personal.
You're right. And I worked at a literary agency, so in New York City, so I know exactly what you mean.
if you talk to anyone who reads slush piles, it's just, you know, some of it is just a numbers game. You know, you happen to hit the right person on the day when they're like, you know, I could really use such and such a story, and you know, you hit them on that day with that story, and it works. Whereas if it had been yesterday, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, I always tell a story. I recommended to my boss that she pass on a novel that sold a few weeks later for $1.5 million. So,
if you talk to agents in New York and editors, every one of them has a story like, "Oh, I passed on 50 Shades of Grey," or "I passed on Harry Potter," or whatever. You know, they all have these stories about the one that got away. As it were. So that's good advice. Keep trying and, you know, be persistent. In the modern world, you know, we're in a really interesting time as far as self-publishing goes. And I think that's still kind of in flux and changing rapidly. And so it's really hard to give good advice. And obviously I'm not qualified anyway, since I don't do that. My advice would be, don't rush into it. I see a lot of people who you know, finish the draft of a book and just throw it up on Amazon, and they're like, "Haha, I'm published." And that's just not going to get you anywhere. I think it was Michael Sullivan who said something like, you know, if you're self-publishing a book, your goal should be for it to be as good as any book that comes out of a traditional publisher. And that means, you know, editing and revising and getting a good cover and all that stuff if you want it to get anywhere. So I'm not saying like never do self-publishing, but you got to really take it seriously.
Sure. So what books and authors have you read lately that impressed you or that inspired you that you would mention?
Lately, huh? That's interesting.
Or, you know, we can expand that to like the last year or two.
Let's see. I read a lot of history, and that is often fine. Inspiring.
Any nonfiction history books that you'd mention?
So I read Steven Pinker's book, several of his books, The Better Angels of Our Nature and The Blank Slate, which are both really good in terms of nonfiction. It's kind of like a human behavior. The Better Angels of Our Nature is about violence and the nature of violence and where it comes from and why we live now in a much less violent society than any humans have ever lived in. So it's actually a really optimistic book, which is kind of unusual. So I recommend that. And then historically, I've been reading Robert Massey, who wrote Dreadnought, which is probably one of my favorite historical books of all time, about the naval arms race between Britain and Germany before World War I. And he also wrote, but now he's writing about the Russian nobility. So I read his book about Peter the Great, which was fantastic. In terms of fiction, I'm pulling up my list here. I keep lists obsessively. I read You by Austin Grossman, which is great if you like video games or are interested in the sort of history and practice of video games. I think is just fantastic. I read Neil Gaiman's new book, which I love. I'm a Neil Gaiman fan from way back. His short stories are probably some of the best short story writing I know of. So that was great. After Cameron Hurley published an article online about women in genre fiction and how not to treat them. And that was really good. And I ended up reading her book, God's War, which I really liked. It's kind of a weird science fiction thing set in a world where they have, you know, organic insectoid life to do all their work, basically, you know, so they have insects, almost magic, although it's sort of technically a science fictional setting. I like Brian McClellan's book, obviously. It's not that similar to Thousand Names overall. Like, it's a very different thrust, I'd say. But the setting is at least vaguely similar. So if you enjoy kind of muskets and magic, that's definitely... Promise of Blood is the name of his book. Definitely.
That's on my to-be-read list, so...
Yeah.
Great. Well, what are you working on now in terms of your writing?
Let me mention one more book.
Okay.
I read Peter Hamilton's Great North Road. I love Peter Hamilton. His Void trilogy and the Pandora Star duology are both fantastic. And Great North Road is a standalone, although it's a gigantic tome. It's like 1,000 pages. But really just a wonderful kind of near future. Well, not that near, but sort of... He has a gift for writing science fictional futures with like recognizable human beings in them, which is really kind of not all that common. So Great North Road is wonderful.
Great.
Sorry. Go ahead and ask that other question again.
Oh, I was just wondering, what are you working on now in terms of your writing?
So I have two series, actually. I have a middle grade series. So that's for like 8 to 12 year olds. The first book is called The Forbidden Library, and that comes out in April. So I'm kind of alternating between that and the Thousand Names series, the Shadow Campaigns. I have finished the Forbidden Library is done, and I've written the sequel to it. And right now I'm working on editing the Shadow Throne, which is the new title for the second book in the Shadow Campaigns, which is like, I'm trying to think how much I can say without spoiling it for everyone. They go back to the home country, to Vordon, and you know, there's politics and intrigue and a bunch of other really good stuff. I'm really, really excited about it. It's a lot of fun.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to that next year. So where can people find you online if they're interested?
Well, if you go to djangowexler.com, that's my sort of home. And that has all links to everything. In particular, since this is the sort of release period for Thousand Names, there's a bunch of blog posts that I wrote, and I try to make my blog posts actually, you know, talk about something that I find interesting rather than just saying, hey, you know, buy my book over and over again.
That's probably probably helpful.
Well, you never know. I mean, it's hard. It makes it easier for me to write anyway. Yeah. It gets a little boring writing, you know, buy my book over and over again. There's that scene from The Critic with the robot that goes, buy my book. Yeah. People can check that out. And I'm also collecting reviews of The Thousand Names. There have been some very kind reviews from various sources. Social media-wise, I spend most of my time on Twitter. So if you go to Twitter at Django Wexler, that's me. If you can't spell my name, by the way, it's D-J-A-N-G-O. Although now that Quentin Tarantino came out with his movie, everybody knows how to spell it. Before that, people would be like, what, Django?
The D is silent.
D is silent, indeed. or if you do Facebook, then if you go to, I think it's, let me look here. It's author Django Wexler. That's my Facebook profile, which is mostly just ported from my Twitter. But if you prefer to read it that way, that's also good. So that's where you can find me online.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Django Wexler, author of the new Flintlock fantasy, The Thousand Names, and the book is available in bookstores now, so go grab a copy. And Django, thanks for doing this interview.
You're very welcome.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.